Hey friends, this episode of The Fellow on Call is not meant to be used for medical advice and is intended for educational purposes only. Patient information has been modified to ensure privacy. The views expressed in this episode do not necessarily reflect the views of our employers. Enjoy!
Welcome to another episode of The Fellow on Call, the Hemong Podcast. We're coming at you from Rulo University Medical Center. I'm Ronak.
I'm Vivek.
And I'm Dan.
And in today's episode, we continue on our colorectal cancer journey, this time focusing on stage 2 colon cancer and a variety of other topics as well related to this disease. Guys, we see a lot of stage 2 colon cancer, even in our fellow clinics as well. And so I think, once again, this whole series, but especially this episode, is going to be really, really high yield. I love how we talk about some of those high risk features that we've been alluding to in our prior episodes. And now our listeners actually get to see when that information becomes applicable for decision making purposes.
And we'll make sure to give you the flip side of this on where did this stuff come from, and how should you actually use this information to counsel your patients? Don't just follow the guideline, actually think about it. And we're here to give you all of that information so that you and your patient can make the decision together, because this is truly a shared decision-making process.
I don't do a lot of oncology anymore, but I always support thinking and I always support shared decision-making. So let's do it.
That sounds good. All right, without further ado, let's roll that show. Guys, I've been thinking about this for a little bit, and I'm curious, what does your partner or spouse think is your biggest quirk? Dan, you have this huge smile on your face, so I'm going to let you go first. What does Logan think is your biggest quirk?
He has told me that I have very specific preferences about things that he didn't realize you could have a preference about. I have like a favorite style of coffee grinder. I have a favorite variety of olive oil, like things that he didn't realize there are multiple different types of. I have a preference on that. Fortunately, he's not annoyed by it, as far as I can tell.
For some reason, I'm not that surprised by that, to be completely honest with you. Yeah, what about you?
So my quirk is really interesting. It has to do with our animals. We have a dog and a cat. And I've created these personas for the animals. I think a lot of people do this. They just, you know, maybe not everybody talks about it, but I guarantee everyone does this. So I don't know if this is a bad quirk, but it is. So our dog, she is like a detective and she's really intense. She's a red heeler Australian cattle dog. And our cat just doesn't really care and kind of does her own thing, but technically is the dog's secretary. So the cat takes all the papers and she's supposed to file them away, but then she ends up just shredding them. And that's the persona I've created and I stick to it very frequently. Might be a little bit quirky, but you know what? It's a lot of fun.
From the picture I've seen of your cat, that totally makes sense. There was this picture that you had at your desk when you were a fellow, and it's kind of just staring with contempt into the camera, paws folded under his torso. So that was, I could see that.
Your cat does like coming on camera every time we used to have conferences and you were on Teams or whatever. The cat always seemed to make an appearance in every single conference. I think that Jan's quirk for me would be that when I'm cooking, I keep all the cabinets open of any cabinet I open to take anything out of. And I also have a tendency to not put anything back until after I'm done preparing the meal, which ends up meaning that there's just a variety of bottles and pots and pans and spatulas and things sort of just spread out all over the place. And then she'll walk in and be like, what happened in here? And I'm like, don't worry about it. So my hope one day is that I can put things back as I use them. But until then, it is what it is. So guys, you know, in today's episode, we're shifting gears once again. Last time we talked all about the stage 3 adjuvant approach to colon cancer management. And this time we are going to talk about stage 2 and a few other topics related to this as well. And so Vivek, do you want to start our episode off with another case?
Yeah. So we have a 55-year-old male who presents to medical oncology clinic for consideration of adjuvant chemotherapy for colon adenocarcinoma. He had recently undergone emergent right hemicolectomy after presenting with a bowel obstruction. Final pathology after resecting the mass was notable for a well-differentiated colon adenocarcinoma that invaded the visceral peritoneum. There were no nodes involved out of 14 total removed. There was no vascular perineural invasion. The tumor was microsatellite stable, and IHC showed proficient MMR status, and there was no metastatic disease on staging imaging. So his stage is T4A N0, stage 2 colon adenocarcinoma. How do we think about adjuvant chemotherapy for these patients?
So for stage two patients, again, by definition, they have no nodal involvement, but they have to have had depth of invasion at least through the muscularis layer. Adjuvant chemotherapy is a little bit trickier in this population. It shouldn't be offered to just all comers with stage two. Some subpopulations within stage two, we're seeing five-year disease-free survivals sort of in the 70s to mid-80s percent in terms of just being treated with surgery alone. And making this decision, the MSI or the microsatellite stability and mismatch repair status is really, really important. We know that patients that are MSI high or are MMR deficient do not benefit from adjuvant chemotherapy when they have stage two disease. Throughout this episode, we'll discuss the rationale and some potential explanations for that, which we've kind of touched on in prior episodes, but that's a really, really important thing to keep in mind. And remember to check out the intro episode for additional details on what MSI and MMR refer to and what that really means. After thinking about MSI status and MMR status, you have to determine whether the patient is T3 or T4, because we know that T4 patients are much higher risk than T3. Once that tumor has invaded into the visceral peritoneum or beyond, we're thinking about a more aggressive disease with poorer outcomes. And remember, T3 is just invasion through the muscularis propria. That T4A is when you've invaded into the visceral peritoneum, and T4B is invasion into other surrounding structures. The last thing you need to think about is, does this patient have high-risk clinicopathologic factors, including bowel obstruction, perforation, fewer than 12 nodes examined, and the thought there being the nodes that we looked at don't have any disease in them, but it wasn't a complete nodal evaluation time surgery, poorly differentiated histology, and perineural or vascular invasion. So bowel obstruction, perforation, fewer nodes than 12, poorly differentiated, or perineural vascular invasion. These are the high-risk clinical pathologic features that can also influence your decision on adjuvant treatment.
So our patient has T4A and presented with a bowel obstruction, so that's another high-risk feature. And we'll talk in this episode that really where these high-risk features came from is very, very important. So why does risk stratification matter for patients with stage 2 colon cancer?
From a 30,000-foot view, I think people would argue that risk stratification always matters, as we've been saying with a lot of our diseases. But I think, Vivek, what you're alluding to is, what is the deeper meaning behind this? And is there data to support this? Do we need to be giving these patients chemotherapy if all that cancer is cut out and they have great disease-free survival rates, even at the five-year mark? So the short answer to your question is that each meta-analysis that's been done in this space has never really shown an overall survival benefit when we look at all patients with stage 2 disease. That's the key component there. So this is why oncologists have worked to try to determine who's going to actually benefit from this and who isn't. And a lot of the data that we have is older, but the older data does show survival in patients with stage 2 disease, that is T4B/N0 colon cancer. And these patients sometimes have worse outcomes than patients with stage 3 T3N1 colon cancer that we discuss in our intro episode. And we'll put a link to this study in our show notes by Gunderson and colleagues. But this is really, really important to understand, is that although you can say someone is only stage 2 or only stage 3, there's a lot more implications. And this is why we also want you guys to think about the T and N classification when you're thinking about the person's staging. So as we discussed in our stage 3 episodes, studies that were done in the 80s and 90s looked at 5-FU monotherapy, sometimes in combination with either other agents or the anti-Helminth therapy, levimazole. And this was for patients with either modern stage 2 or stage 3 colon cancer. The first large study to show a lack of benefit for stage 2 patients was a pooled analysis through an international collaboration called IMPACT-B2, and that was published in the JCO in 2009. And in this study, they looked at over 1,000 patients, and what they found was there was no benefit seen from those who got adjuvant 5-FU compared to surgery alone. The five-year event-free survival was around 75% in both groups, and the overall survival was roughly 80%. Another pivotal meta-analysis published in 2008 of these older studies also showed no difference in disease-free survival or overall survival in stage 2 patients. So remember, this is all patients with stage 2 disease. So again, we need to ask ourselves, is there still a subset of this population that may benefit from therapy? And we haven't quite figured that out based on these two studies so far. There was a phase 3 randomized controlled trial that compared 5-FU to observation in stage 2 patients called the QUASAR study. Another really, really important one you need to know to look like a rock star when you go to GI clinic. But the trial name stood for quick and simple and reliable to reflect its pragmatic trial design. So patients with colorectal cancer from 19 countries were enrolled if the clinician thought there was an uncertain indication for adjuvant chemotherapy in the stage 2 setting. This thought of uncertain indication was not clearly defined at all, which is a major limitation of the study, but nonetheless, the study was done. There were nearly 3,000 patients that were enrolled who had stage 2 disease randomized to either some sort of 5-FU monotherapy with or without levimizole and differing doses of leucovorin versus observation. And about a third of patients actually had T4 disease or vascular invasion. There was a reduced risk of recurrence and overall survival benefit of absolute 3.5%. The biggest issue was that most of the benefit in recurrence was seen in rectal cancer, and there was no statistically significant benefit in colon cancer patients. Pathologic data to determine other high-risk features were also available for 20% of the population, so it was unclear if there was a different benefit for that group. Heterogeneous treatments among patients also made it hard to get definitive conclusions. This did show, though, that the benefit in survival was very marginal with adjuvant chemotherapy in this patient population. So, in these older studies, there was retrospective work to determine high-risk features, which is where we derive that clinical pathologic risk factors. So there's actually a study in a pathology journal in 2000 that suggested that routinely testing for perineural and vascular invasion should be considered. And we'll provide a link of this in our show notes. But remember that a lot of this information was derived at a time when it may be less relevant than it is now with our modern day approach to management. The major problem is that it is very likely that patients were inadequately staged in the older time period without good preoperative imaging and inadequate lymph node dissections. So these risk factors may not actually be as important today as they were back then. Last important thing to note is that these prognostic factors were never established as predictive for benefit from chemotherapy. They are just things that we have learned along the way to look out for, and we use them as surrogates to try and anticipate someone having higher risk of recurrence of their disease.
Yeah, and I think that's really important. So when you think about something that's prognostic, it just means it was associated with a poor outcome, but it may not predict benefit from chemotherapy. And we have not shown, as we go through this episode, there is no randomized trial evidence saying that these high risk factors predict benefit from chemotherapy versus observation. And it's crazy to me that there was a paper in ASCO guidelines update in 2004 where they said, hey, we're not sure what these risk factors mean. And then you read the most recent one in like 2022 or 23, and they say the exact same thing. We have not run a randomized study to answer this question. So this really shows that we need to be careful to select for the patients that we offer adjuvant chemotherapy to. Patients with no clinical pathologic high-risk features and T3 disease should not be offered chemotherapy based on the data. So what's the deal with T4 and these high-risk features? And let's talk about this because that's what our patient has in our clinic.
So keep in mind that throughout this discussion, we're talking about patients with T4 tumors who are not MSI high, so they're microsatellite stable, or MMR proficient, meaning they do not have MMR deficiency. Those patients should not get chemotherapy based on what we know right now. There were numerous observational retrospective studies that have shown improvement in recurrence and occasionally overall survival when comparing adjuvant chemotherapy to observation for patients with T4 or other high risk factors in stage 2 disease. These studies overall have a fairly low level of quality in terms of like quality of evidence. But there were a few pooled analyses with larger patient populations that we wanted to highlight. Both of these studies were published back in 2014, about 10 years now, as of the recording and release of this episode. The first study was a systematic review and meta-analysis that looked at 25 studies published after 2005. It included over 15,000 patients with stage 2 colon cancer. And what they saw was there was no difference in disease-free survival or overall survival with adjuvant chemotherapy versus observation. Importantly, univariate and multivariate analysis confirmed the prognostic significance of the typical high-risk clinical and pathologic risk factors that we discussed. There was no pre-specified subgroup analyses that could tease apart the benefit in that subpopulation, these patient subpopulations, based on some of the poor reporting of data in the trials that were included. And we'll have a link to that study in our show notes. The second study was a population-based analysis from British Columbia, looking at patients that were treated between 1998 and 2008. There were 1,700 patients included, and they grouped patients beforehand as high risk if they had T4 or any other high-risk feature that we discussed before, and low risk if they just had T3 disease. Most high-risk stage 2 patients did not receive adjuvant chemotherapy, given the lack of benefit in that pivotal impact analysis and other prior meta-analyses. There were about 375 patients who did end up getting chemo, and over 900 who did not, who were also high risk. There was improved recurrence-free survival and overall survival favoring the chemotherapy group. However, this benefit was limited to those patients with T4 disease. Patients who just had the other high risk factors and not T4 disease, so T3 patients with high risk factors, did not seem to show any benefit from chemotherapy. And that includes patients with two or more high-risk features. So an interesting outcome. You know, we think about these things. We always hear these high-risk features, but it seems like it was the T4 component of this that was really driving those outcomes. As expected, this analysis once again showed that there was no benefit in treating patients with T3 disease and no other risk factors as well. Both of these studies really show it's unclear whether these patients really need adjuvant chemotherapy, right? The T4 seems to be the most important thing in determining whether or not somebody's going to benefit from chemotherapy if they have stage 2 disease.
I think that this presents a really tough situation when we counsel our patients, because based on the data that we've just discussed already in our episode, as we're alluding to, this is really tough when we're counseling our patients. And so based on the studies that we've discussed already in our episode, there is still a very small benefit, about 3.5% of offering chemotherapy. But what we haven't yet discussed is, what are the implications of giving somebody that therapy? Are we over-treating patients simply because they have one of those high risk factors, when in reality, they may be someone that's never going to recur? And most of these patients, I assume, based on the studies we've discussed, would have gotten 5-FU monotherapy. We previously talked about the role of oxaliplatin in the stage 3 setting. Is there any role for oxaliplatin in the stage 2 setting?
We discussed the pivotal MOSAIC trial that was published in New England Journal 2004 initially, which established FOLFOX as a standard of care for adjuvant therapy in stage 3 patients in one of our last episodes. But remember, this study also included stage 2 patients, so let's focus in on that population and see how they did. So remember, at the time, 5-FU monotherapy was the standard of care. There was a lot of controversy among oncologists whether we should give stage 2 patients any chemotherapy. But MOSAIC said, well, let's still randomize stage 2 patients, and we're randomizing them FOLFOX versus 5-FU monotherapy, no observation arm. So there's a 10-year follow-up study that we'll link to our show notes. And if you click on it, look at table 1 of that paper, because it really highlights how patients did based on stage 2, stage 3, high risk, low risk. And you can really see that really well fleshed out. There are about 900 patients in total who had stage 2 disease, and half got FOLFOX and half got 5-FU monotherapy. The 5-year disease-free survival and overall survival were not different between the two arms. But then you ask, what about those high-risk stage 2 patients? They pre-specified that analysis in MOSAIC, which also tells you how old these risk factors were developed, really in an era that's outdated. And so for high-risk stage 2 patients, based on, you know, the T4 or the other factors, there was no statistical difference in disease-free survival. But there was a noted possible 5% absolute improvement in 10-year disease-free survival favoring FOLFOX over 5-FU monotherapy. And there was notably no difference in overall survival, which is extremely important. So this is a very limited analysis, no significant difference, exploratory analysis. And people can use this to say, well, some high-risk patients could theoretically get oxaliplatin therapy, but this shouldn't be routinely offered. This is a very weak, low level of evidence. The second thing is, we talked last week about the duration, 3 versus 6 months of therapy. There was another analysis of IDEA that came out where we looked at, what about stage 2 patients, 3 versus 6 months of therapy? And what we really found is for CAPOX, like we found in the total population, there's really no difference between 3 versus 6 months, that 3 months of therapy is sufficient if you're adding oxaliplatin. And for FOLFOX, maybe there's a little bit more difference, but the numbers were very small, but really just kind of favored 3 months of therapy is enough. But then you might be wondering, well, what about monotherapy? You know, the IDEA trial, so we've kind of established now, hey, oxaliplatin's probably not needed in stage two. It's probably not doing that much, even in high-risk patients. But what about the duration of 5-FU monotherapy? And there was a meta-analysis that showed that you do need 6 months, that you can't get away with 3 months. So if you do 5-FU monotherapy, you do need a true 6 months of therapy. So oxaliplatin, probably not needed. That seems way overkill. But if you do therapy, if you do 5-FU monotherapy, you'd need 6 months. 3 months is too little.
All right. So thanks for going over all that. Super helpful. Let's get back to our case. Our patient has a T4A N0 colon cancer and presented with bowel obstruction. We talked about the weak level of evidence on bowel obstruction as a high risk feature to determine whether or not to give chemotherapy, but he also has T4 disease. And so when we counseled him, we discussed that the survival benefit of adjuvant capecitabine or 5-FU monotherapy is likely about 3-4% in terms of absolute improvement. And the addition of oxaliplatin may add a percentage point here or there. He opted for surveillance without treatment, but asked about the role of circulating tumor DNA. He had read about this on the internet and the lay press and was like, oh yeah, there's this thing, ctDNA, what is that? So can you tell us what the role of ctDNA or circulating tumor DNA is for patients with stage 2 colon cancer?
So if you completed a recent fellowship in oncology, you may have never heard about the genomics of colon cancer. What we found really interesting when we're preparing for this episode is that there used to be an oncotype. Actually, so talking about genomics and DNA and colon cancer, there is an oncotype, like in breast cancer, made for colon cancer, which honestly I'd never heard of because you just don't hear about it anymore. And, you know, they tried to develop this recurrence score, tried to use that in the same way the breast cancer researchers did, and it just didn't pan out. They never took it to a randomized trial. Maybe it wasn't working as well. And I said, hey, look, technology's improved. Now we can do these amazing liquid biopsies. Just do a peripheral blood test and see if there's cancer left over. The best minimal residual disease, measurable residual disease, right? Can we detect a scrap of colon cancer left over? And it's important to know that this isn't perfect, but there are several retrospective studies and some prospective studies that showed a strong prognostic role that patients who didn't have overt radiographic evidence of disease had a very poor disease-free survival when they had positive circulating tumor DNA. It was a way to predict this early, potentially, in the same way that we might use a CEA and things like that. So in order to better understand the role of ctDNA to guide adjuvant therapy for colon cancer, there's a randomized study that was done and recently published in the New England Journal of Medicine in 2022 called Dynamic. So this study enrolled stage 2 colon cancer patients regardless of high-risk features. And the patients were randomized 2-to-1 to ctDNA-guided adjuvant therapy versus standard clinical practice guided by clinical and pathologic features. The study was designed as non-inferiority, accepting a loss of 8.5% in 2-year disease-free survival, which to me seems ridiculous. If you think about IDEA, when we're talking like, you know, a little over 2% that we're willing to give up, and we think about the actual absolute benefit in stage 2 patients is only maybe 3-4%, 5% max, that seems like a lot. But that's what they did, and it was pragmatic in order to make the power reasonable for this study. And there were about 300 patients in the ctDNA group and 150 patients in the conventional group. Interestingly, 40% of patients were high risk based on the standard clinical and pathologic features, and only 15% had T4 disease, which, you know, we think of as some of the highest risk patients. Interestingly, 20% of patients, so a fifth of the cohort, had MMR deficient tumors. And remember, these patients actually have inferior survival when they're given 5-FU monotherapy compared to observation. So it was shocking to me that all of these patients were also included, but that's how the study design was done. So when you looked at it, those who had ctDNA-guided therapy, meaning if my ctDNA is positive, I'm going to give adjuvant chemotherapy, they had a roughly 10% percentage points, absolute percentage point decrease in the use of any chemotherapy compared to the conventional group. So 10% total use less of chemotherapy and no difference in disease-free survival. So that sounds great, right? Like, this is decreasing all chemotherapy that we're giving to patients. We're not losing anything on disease-free survival. But then you look at it closer, and when you look at it, oxaliplatin use was significantly higher in the ctDNA group. Of the patients who got chemotherapy, over 60% got oxaliplatin in the ctDNA group compared to only 10% in the conventional group. So the relative risk of getting oxaliplatin was like 2.5. So you have a 2.5 higher chance of getting neuropathy-inducing chemotherapy with ctDNA without any benefit in disease-free survival. The other interesting thing was a negative ctDNA but high clinical risk, so I have no ctDNA, but maybe I have one of those higher clinical risk features, those patients had a similar risk of recurrence to positive ctDNA patients. Granted, these positive ctDNA patients got chemotherapy, but it kind of just shows you that ctDNA is not perfect. Even those who were negative still had recurrences. It's not a perfect metric. And so although ctDNA cut down on total number of patients who got chemo, it certainly increases the use of oxaliplatin. If we used it in prime time, I would worry that if I were an oncologist, I'd look at both the path report and ctDNA, potentially be even using even more oxaliplatin, right? So I don't know if this is cutting down on chemotherapy use. It's certainly increasing oxaliplatin use and maybe cutting down on 5-FU monotherapy use.
Based on that discussion, I think it's important that we let our patient know that ctDNA is not ready for prime time. And as we know, we don't really use that clinically in our clinics either, unless patients are enrolled on a study, in which case it may be being utilized. So this isn't a perfect biomarker, as we just discussed, and we don't exactly know what to do with that information based on the current treatment algorithm. This is a theme over and over as we're trying to utilize ctDNA and MRD testing more and more in different disease types. It's amazing that we can do this in today's day and age, but we don't yet know what to do with that information. So again, just because we can, does that mean that we should at this moment in 2024? So there was another study that was presented recently at ASCO GI in 2024 called the COBRA trial that randomized patients with low-risk stage 2 colon cancer to observation versus ctDNA-guided therapy. This is semi-groundbreaking because this is almost hot off the presses at the time that we're recording this. Dan, can you walk us through what the highlights of this study were?
This was a really fascinating study. They did something really interesting. They randomized patients up front first to understand whether ctDNA could clear on its own or if there would be improved clearance with the addition of chemotherapy. The preliminary results showed futility. Essentially, the trial was halted with clearance of ctDNA at the six-month mark in about 43% of the observation arm and only 11% in the chemotherapy arm, which is a pretty surprising result. And it really solidifies the fact that the assay and the patient population that we're looking at with ctDNA really matters. And we need to wait for better randomized, controlled, high-quality evidence before using this in clinical practice on a regular basis. And I think the last thing that we should talk about is microsatellite instability status, so MSI high. We discussed this in the stage 3 episode, but let's recap why 5-FU monotherapy is thought to be detrimental.
There was a pivotal study done by Sargent and colleagues that was published in the JCO in 2010 that showed that MSI-high or MMR-deficient tumors had worse disease-free survival and overall survival in a pooled analysis from older studies that were done in the 1990s and the early 2000s that were specifically looking at 5-FU monotherapy as adjuvant treatment, particularly in patients with stage 2 disease. A mouthful, but essentially stating that patients that had MSI-high or MMR-deficient tumors had worse outcomes with 5-FU monotherapy. The thought was that chemotherapy may be blunting that immune response and does not allow for the normal immune surveillance to get rid of residual disease after cancer. This is why the group wanted to look at this patient population in the MOSAIC trial to see if FOLFOX had any benefit by MMR status. Unlike the prior studies, there was a trend towards benefit in disease-free survival and overall survival in patients with deficient MMR, though not statistically significant. And remember that this is compared to 5-FU monotherapy, not observation. So some would argue that the oxaliplatin may overcome the negative impact of 5-FU monotherapy, but the evidence is lacking and particularly weak for stage 2 patients. So at this time, it's really, really not suggested for the general population.
So thinking about like the opposite of that, if 5-FU is blunting the immune system that's causing a problem, is there any role for immunotherapy, like unleashing the immune system in these patients with MMR deficient or MSI high tumors?
This is definitely where the field is heading. And this is why it's so hard when you hear, well, somebody raises their hand and say, I believe that oxaliplatin overcomes the 5-FU detriment. And it's like, that doesn't really make a whole lot of sense when we have things like Ipi-Nivo and Dostarlimab and all these immunotherapy agents, right? Why are we talking about oxaliplatin? We have this new stuff, which is really, fortunately, what's going to happen soon. So we'll discuss the incredible Dostarlimab study for rectal cancer and really soon, actually, upcoming episode on that. But for colon cancer, there was a study presented recently in 2022 from the Netherlands called NICHE-2. And this was a neoadjuvant immunotherapy study looking at ipilimumab plus nivolumab for high-risk stage 2 and stage 3 patients. A majority of these patients had stage 3 disease. There was a few stage 2 patients, but it was pretty impressive. There was an impressive 66% pathologic CR rate at the time of surgery, which really shows that this is promising. And we look forward to future publications and trials looking at the incorporation of immunotherapy for these patients, because that's really what we need to be doing. In an era where we're giving things like pembrolizumab and melanoma, nivolumab and melanoma adjuvantly, renal cell carcinoma, we need to be doing this for our colon cancer patients, especially for our young colon cancer patients. So we'll link a few things to our show notes. It is really promising. It's really exciting. And that's where we should head. We should stop this from 2004 to now. The same ASCO guidelines have said, we're not sure if these high-risk features matter. We're not sure what to do with stage 2 colon cancer. It's about time we run a proper randomized study for these patients. And it's about time that we run a proper randomized study for the MMR-deficient patients, particularly because they will benefit probably very well from immunotherapy. And that's what we look forward to. The great researchers in the field are really doing this. We're just reporting our thoughts and really giving you the data.
So I think then, based on our conversation today, at least what I'm taking away from this is that it goes back to the art of medicine when we see patients with stage 2 disease. So confirmed stage 2 disease is, as Dan said in the beginning, a shared decision-making process. And we can present our patient with the option of considering adjuvant therapy, especially if they have one of these high-risk features, based on the limited evidence that we have to date. With the caveat, though, that the benefit is quite small and quite marginal. And I think it would also be, at least I would prefer, to also hear, if I was the patient, to hear what the implications of being on 5-FU therapy were. If I'm only going to get a 3.5% benefit, you know, what does that mean? How often do I have to come? A lot of our patients drive really far. How often do they have to drive to clinic? Is that all worth it? And so these are all the different aspects of the shared decision-making process that we need to be conscientious of. And as I said last time, in these patients, as far as we know, all the cancer has already been cut out. So all we're trying to do is buy them, you know, a little bit more of almost like that insurance policy without any guarantee that they may be someone that's going to ever recur and have disease recurrence. So certainly an important conversation to have. I'm really glad that we went through this. I think, especially with so many different trials in the colon cancer space, things like this can get really lost. The reality is that a lot of the patients we will see will be the stage 2 and stage 3 patients. So it's super important that if this didn't quite click the first time, go back, listen to it, read through our show notes, go through the prior episode as well. And all of this will become so much more clear. At the end of the day, it's about taking care of patients as best as we possibly can. So guys, any final thoughts that y'all have?
Always keep in mind that some of these high-risk features, even though you read it in the textbook, they were developed in the 90s. And you really have to think that you don't just hang your hat on each one and say, I must give chemo. You should really have this discussion with your patient and know that it's actually, we don't know still today if it's doing all that much for these patients. And if you do choose it, remember 6 months duration when you're doing monotherapy.
What a unique thing in cancer care. How often is it that the more we learn about something, the simpler it gets? And T4, that's what you need to think about. If your patient has T4 disease, start having these discussions.
Absolutely. All right, guys. Well, until next time, we'll see you all later.
See you later.
Peace.